Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show. Episode 435 of the Roguecast, recorded October 10th, 2023, Tree Pun Theory. All right, welcome to Spooky Season Week 2.
Yes.
We will be talking a little bit later about a new horror movie on Amazon Prime that we all actually talked about the trailer for a little while back.
Yep.
We'll be talking about some other horror movies and TV that Nick and I have been watching.
We'll talk about the haunted house thing that Randy and I did the last week.
Yep, Scare for a Cure.
Scare for a Cure, yeah. In which blood sprayed.
We'll also talk about Loki, which is not Halloween themed.
No.
But there are costumes in it.
And
there
I feel
are.
Like I heard one or two horrible reviews for it. No, I actually didn't. I haven't heard a lot on it, so I will be... I'm not catching every single Marvel project, so I'll be interested to hear what you guys say about it. I will take whatever you say as gospel.
Of course.
And assume that it's the Lord's own truth.
The whole truth, yes. The whole truth, nothing but the truth.
The Loki's own truth.
Loki's own truth. All right, before we get to that, though, let's talk about games that came in this week. We are still, I can tell the game companies are ramping up for holidays. We're still getting a fair amount of stuff. We're also getting Kickstarters that I ordered somewhere between 2 and 5 years ago.
Yeah. Classic Kickstarter.
So, we got an RPG called Fight with Spirit. This is an anime style RPG.
Okay.
It's a box set. It is like sports drama. So like your Blue Lock, which we discovered was a soccer manga, right? I think.
I believe it was.
Or is that something else? I think it's Blue Lock.
There's so many different ones.
There's Slam Dunk, which is basketball.
Yep. Right.
There's all kinds of, like... So it's like, if you want to play, like, the sports drama... Also, if you want to think of it in American terms, like Friday Night Lights.
Yeah.
And Mighty Ducks and Ted Lasso.
I have read enough of those sports manga to know that they're really very readable.
Yep.
They will dramatize like a basketball court like nobody's business and like make it into the, like as big as any epic fight sequence or something like that. And yeah, there's always the off the court drama stuff too.
But this game allows you to do multiple different sports. You can do whatever sport you want. You can do ice skating.
What about lacrosse?
Rugby. Pickleball.
Anybody want to play in a pickleball game that I'm running next week?
Pickleball RPG. We're going to play pickleball? No, yes. No, we're going to play a pickleball RPG.
How about badminton?
Badminton, for sure. Absolutely.
Okay.
You can talk about shuttlecocks and birdies.
Is this going to be one of those kind of games where I've got to wait for a supplement to get my precious pickleball?
The Kickstarter edition also comes with two supplements. I can't remember what one of them is, but one of them is like fighting with history, so it's like you can do it as a historical drama instead.
Oh, interesting.
So it's like some fun stuff. It looks very cool. We got that. We also just today got a Kickstarter called Leaf that I played back at Gamma that is a game of you, like, you're building trees and leaves, and you're trying to get, like, different wildlife to come to your tree.
Okay.
It was super fun. It's very cute. And we got that in. So those couple things from Kickstarter.
Let me ask you this, Randy. When you played it, were you able to get through with no puns?
I don't know what you mean.
Are you a leaf peeper?
Were you like somebody was like menacing you and you're like, leave me alone? And
I don't think that ever happened.
Like a tree and leaf?
I don't believe it.
Leaf?
I believe everybody made every tree trunk branch joke.
Is that only when playing games with you do you make the puns?
No, I don't make puns.
Yeah. You just made like three of them.
I referenced that they could be made. Listen, all I'm saying is that trees, for whatever reason, seem to bring out the pun in people. That's the one that people... It's the most accessible series of puns.
This is not a theory I've heard before, the tree pun theory.
All right, we'll look into it.
All right.
I've got some pamphlets if you're interested.
It's Barking Man.
See, there we go. Mix into it.
Dave's got like a, you guys can't see it, but he has like one of those boards with the red string on it, and he's pointing madly at it right now.
Yeah.
We also got the Nightmare Before Christmas game, which looks like I think it's a card based bluffing game.
Should be Making Christmas.
Making Christmas.
Card based bluffing game. That's
I
interesting.
So. Yeah. Yeah.
So this is like a more of a brisk kind of
quick play game.
People like that series. I was always fascinated to see how it was like a kind of a modest, if not slight flop when it came out, and then it became iconic over the years, and they just merchandised it endlessly.
Yeah,
it's the Blade Runner effect.
Yeah, but like Blade Runner is not as merchandisable. You know, people don't want like action figure of. a woman spastically flopping around after being shot. Like, you wind it up and it flops about.
Do they I'm sure there's a market.
There's a market.
Yeah. There's a market for that.
Is that, that was Pris.
It was Pris.
You get the dead Pris action figure.
Given that it was like in the 80s, it'd be like a pull cord thing. You get one of those little zip cords.
Race of replicants.
Yeah. Race of replicants.
Oh, boy. Did that derail?
And Zora goes right through the plate glass. Yeah.
Another Zora crash.
Roy Batty hits like has like stigmata jammed into his finger.
Right, he's got the nail gun car. Yeah.
And he has thumb eye pushing action.
Yeah, you know, that's for his if he was in a speed racer type scenario.
Your Blade Runner really works.
Nightmare Before Christmas has more naturally occurring toy options and little statues and ornaments. And things.
I don't know, Dave. This Blade Runner toy line sounds pretty exciting.
Well, we should keep talking about it for sure. Like, what if they made an action figure of his racist boss?
What if they made a playset where you could do a Voight Kampff test?
that would sell, actually.
Comes with squibs.
Yes, comes with squibs. That's right. You have to. It's almost like Operation. That's it. If you get the wrong answer, your squibs go off.
Oh no!
That's the only way you get the Leon action figure.
Oh, no, I got Blade Runner.
Oh, no, he's a replicant.
He's a replicant. Tell me about your mother.
You see a turtle upside down.
Anyway, yes, Nightmare Before Christmas is actually huge in Japan. Apparently, and I think that's why they started making figures and ornaments and all
that. That would sort of explain, honestly, Japan has such a high quality level when it comes to those kind of things.
I mean,
that would explain why I've seen so many really well made.
I mean, at Halloween time, at least a quarter of a Hot Topic is all Nightmare Before Christmas.
That's true. Yeah. It just happens. They didn't even stock it.
Overnight.
The Pumpkin King just comes in from the ventilation shaft.
Yep.
Takes about a couple 150 and ones just for whatever reasons.
Yeah.
His own thing.
Well, look, Halloween Town doesn't run on nothing.
I Jack the Pumpkin King.
Why did you
rob the till? He makes even petty theft dramatic.
Dude, you were talking before we started recording about fumes coming in. Fumes coming into the vents. This is one of those days.
So, if to bring it back home again, so there's a Nightmare Before Christmas card game, huh?
Yes, correct.
Oh, interesting. maybe that's what my original reaction should have been. Very cool.
No, I like that.
I want a board game of Jack breaking into various Hot Topics.
It's like Monopoly. You got to steal the $150
exactly. He and Sally race against time to see who can break into the most Hot Topics.
Well, zero. Yeah.
And if he gets caught, the squibs go off. not enough games have squibs in them. I think we really ought to start that as a trend.
That should be a thing.
Or those caps.
There's also a game, Waterfall Park, which is about you building in a water park, which sounds kind of fun.
Number of squibs in it?
No squibs that I know of.
Ooh.
Can you make a very deadly water park?
I'm sure you can.
Like that one in the 80s.
Sorry, so this is a game of, like, building rival water parks, building the best water park?
I believe it is. I should look this up, actually, see what it actually says it is. You actually got to put board games, or it gives me
you will actually be directed to a true water
trade
park.
And exchange attractions to build the biggest amusement park in the world.
Oh, trade and exchange. That sounds actually kind of cool. So you're...
Particularity of this park is from the publisher. That's a weird word to use.
Particularity, got it.
Is that it is built vertically on huge towers in the middle of the ocean.
Okay, that's weird too. So it's like a normal park but built on the water.
Built on the water.
So
it's
like
Waterfall Park.
It's an Atlantean water park?
No, not under the water.
Not under the water, on top of the water.
On top of the water.
It's a water world water.
So, like, if you take a bad step off of a platform leaving a roller coaster, you just plunge to the ocean below and die.
I will get a Kevin Costner lookalike to wander around.
A Gillman.
A Gillman.
Yeah. We got another game called Sides, which is a sort of like co-op-looking party game. You are trying to help two detectives find a mystery word. To do so, the witnesses, give detectives a one-word clue that starts with the letter at either end of the letter card line. The detectives then jointly offer an answer, and if they found a solution, two other players become the detective. This sounds like a fun little word game.
It sounds a little like, well, what's the other game where you have spy teams guessing your words?
Codenames.
I love Codenames.
A little bit like that.
Very fun game.
This looks very cool. I'm curious about it. And then we got Ticket to Ride Berlin, which is another in the popular Ticket to Ride series.
Mm-hmm.
And we got Darwin's Journey, which is, I think this is a reprint or a recreation of an older game. I could be wrong about that.
Okay.
But it's a worker placement game where you are retracing Darwin's journey to the Galapagos.
That sounds pretty cool.
In a worker placement adventure. This looks like a sort of a heavier game.
Yeah, yeah.
It is rated 8.2 on BoardGameGeek, which is pretty
high. That means serious business.
Yep.
You're like, hey, buddy, go study them turtles.
Yep. That is with 3.8 thousand ratings, so that's a real rating.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, that's the games we got in this week, and now let's talk about comics for this week, for the second week of October, and let's start off with DC's Wesley Dodds, The Sandman. The start of there. They're going to do a series of miniseries featuring the Justice Society in Justice Society times.
Yep. AKA the 1940s.
1940s.
Yeah.
1930s.
Most people know the Justice Society as the dudes fighting Nazis and stuff in World War II.
Yep.
But if you happen to be lucky enough to have been reading at the right time in the 1990s, there was an amazing comic called Sandman Mystery Theater.
Yep.
It ran concurrent with the, you know, insanely popular Neil Gaiman Sandman, and had the lightest of tangential links. He actually, Morpheus seemed to, like, send dreams to Wesley Dodds.
Yes, I think that was how the Neil Gaiman was, when he created the Sandman, they were like, you know, there's already a Sandman, and he, like, there's actually two, there's Jack Kirby's Sandman as well.
Yeah, he played off of all
and
of that stuff.
And he took part of all that, but, yeah, Wesley Dodds basically had these visions of Morpheus trapped, and Morpheus was sending him dreams that were then making him, like, go out as a crime fighter.
Yeah. And he's got that pulp, that Rorschach-y kind of cool pulp look. A trench coat and a fedora and a gas mask and a gas gun that has knockout gas. And he's a little bit of, especially per that 90s series, and which this clearly keys off of,
yes.
Although it's a little more adventuresome.
Yep.
His design is amazing.
He's a little bit of he's a smart, he was kind of an intellectual.
He's a bookish nerd.
Bookish
nerd pacifist. He's
yep.
And then
but like, I will say this, for a pacifist, he's like, he knows like judo and stuff like that,
yes.
In the style of sort of the pulp heroes.
Yep.
He can beat a dude up.
Also, one of the great romances in comic, he had a socialite named Diane Belmont, who turned out to be a private, sort of a investigator on her own.
Yeah, and
her dad was district attorney.
Given that most superheroes were kind of stuck in the perpetual dating and then not dating and then dating and then not dating vibe, they actually allowed these characters to have a sort of a romance that progressed from kind of awkward flirtation to, I guess, to marriage.
Yeah,
I think,
marriage.
And all
she
that.
She also like knew who he was.
That was a big thing. And before they kind of started outing all the superhero identities in the Bendis era.
Yep.
This was one of the ones that really did it right.
Matt Wagner and Steven Siegel did it first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway,
no face, Bendis.
Whether you've read that Sandman or not, and you should, we got a big omnibus of the first like three or four trades worth. Essentially.
Yep. But this does sort of stand perfectly well on its own.
Yep. It is by Robert Venditti, has art by Riley Rossmo. The art is particularly spectacular.
Yeah.
He's definitely keying off of sort of Will Eisner a little bit. But also
Guy Davis, who drew the 90s one. But like,
but also it's a very unique, like, cartoony style.
He's
like, it's
a little more cartoony than you might be used to for DC, but we've I think, liked a lot of Riley Rossmo's artwork for DC. You just gotta, if you plug into the style, it's real cool.
It is.
Like, look up any of his stuff. His art's good.
Well, this is the first of a Start miniseries. There's also going to be a Golden Age Flash and a Golden Age Green Lantern one coming out. But, yeah, worth a look. I think we all really enjoyed this.
Mm-hmm.
DC also has a new Black Label book from artist Christian Ward, who is also writing, called Batman City of Madness. Black Label means it's out of continuity. But basically, this is a sort of a darker Batman. And it is about him facing off with Two-Face, who maybe is developing a third personality, and the city, the Court of Owls, involved, and they have a something they've been keeping underground that seems to have escaped. There's a little bit of a Cthulhu vibe to it.
Yep.
Yeah. Not all, but many Black Label projects. It's the sort of oversized format, and you know, with the nice cardstock cover and all that stuff. But yeah, if you like a sort of a suspense mystery Batman story that involves some Lovecraftian elements, and also the Court of Owls, which that seems like a pretty good mix to me, check that one out.
It's also very pretty.
It's very pretty.
Oh, yeah.
Superior Spider-Man Returns, in a one-shot from Dan Slott, the originator of that, with Christos Gage co-writing. He's done some of that, too.
I've been telling some of our newer staffers about Superior Spider-Man since it's
not super commonly referenced now, although, right. you know, people who were reading comics, what was it, a decade ago, will certainly recall it. But yeah, that was the period which the what seemed like an insane idea, Dr. Octopus mind switching with Peter Parker or kind yep. of taking over and yep. then taking over the whole book for like 2 years.
It shouldn't work, but it does.
It ended up being really good because the idea was that Dr. Octopus was kind of his actions were also molded by having some of Peter's altruism bouncing around in the head still. And he's like, oh, well, I'll be the superior Spider-Man. I'll, you know, I'll continue saving lives and stuff. But he's like, I'm going to kind of use supervillain methodology yep. and. But he also like went back and he's like, oh, Peter Parker never knew how to manage his time and get things done. And he's like, so he went and got his like graduate degree done and started a company.
Yep.
And that all set up fun stuff for when Peter got back. So like this, really good stuff. And this is a callback.
This takes place in the current time. Dr. Octopus is going down. He discovers this technology that he doesn't remember creating because he did it when he was Superior Spider-Man. He only has vague, like fuzzy kind of
hazy memories. Okay. Yep.
So then they show us the reader. Hit this time where Superior Spider-Man basically created a new supervillain, and how that came about, and it's now going to. So it is a flashback story of that period.
Does Doc Ock not in the present know that Peter is Spider-Man?
I don't know.
I was just thinking if everything kind of became hazy about that experience, I wondered if he might have been how they kept him from knowing.
It's possible. But at any rate, this
seems like a cool idea.
It's a fun idea, and it's going to lead to a modern day Superior Spider-Man coming out in November. So,
yep.
I'm not quite sure how that's going to happen. If he's going to somehow go back to being Spider-Man or what, but this is a good story. This was a good flashback story.
Nice.
There's also a new story called Cap Wolf and the Howling Commandos. If Superior Spider-Man seems obscure to you, let me tell you about Cap Wolf. There was a period in the 90s. When Cap writer Mark Grunwald, who was my definitive Cap writer for me.
Yep. He had many a great Captain America story.
He introduced John Walker, U.S. agent.
Yeah, the Mighty D-Man.
He's the Mighty D-Man. He is my definitive Captain America. He wrote the thing for at least a decade, I think.
But a few stories were a little bit...
Toward the end, started getting a little weird, and Captain America got turned into a werewolf. This is a story that is referenced all the time as sort of this ridiculous thing. Well, that has nothing to do with this. Except that it's probably what gave the idea.
Yep.
This is a just another story of Captain America dealing with Nick Fury and the Howling Commandos in World War II, and a Nazi program that turns him into a werewolf. Which, by the way, is sort of a spoiler. It doesn't happen to the last page of this issue, but you know it's going to happen.
It is the premise of the book, yeah. But yeah, basically that Cap Wolf story from the 80s. Was set in then contemporary times.
Yep.
This is a World War II story, and I guess has to do with some kind of Nazi craziness.
So it's a good story. Basically, Cap. There's a little bit of tension between Cap and the Howling Commandos, which I think is interesting. Nick Fury gets taken out of action, his leg gets busted, and so Cap has to leave the unit. And Dugan is like, "I'm not so sure about this." He's like, "I should be leading the unit." Cap doesn't know us.
Yep.
He's like, he's sort of like, "You're a poster boy. You know, you're not actually a leader."
Yeah. That sounds kind of fun. A little bit of friction.
Some fun stuff. Yeah. And they all have to go on this mission to this mysterious Nazi bunker, which is holding some kind of Nazi secrets, which turn out to be some kind of werewolf formula.
It reminds me a little bit of like that movie Overlord.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, definitely lighter.
When
but
Cap turns, do any of the commandos say, Cap, you're taking the howling part of our commandos thing too literally?
No one says that I've seen yet.
Well, I would like them
Maybe
to.
They will.
Really good artwork.
It is really nice artwork. Yeah, it's a good first issue. Space Usagi returns. For those who don't know, Usagi Dojimbo, the Rabbit Ronin of Stan Sakai's creation, had a mini series that took place in sort of a Star Warsy type thing.
Yeah, his opportunity to do exactly Star Wars type stories.
So he is about to put a colorized version of that out. It's never been colored before. So in preparing for that, he did a one shot called Space Usagi Yokai Hunter. What's a little odd is that this is all just a Usagi story. Usagi fighting various yokai demons.
Like feudal Japan.
And then at the end, it is revealed that it is Space Usagi's daughter reading a Usagi manga about their ancestor.
I guess it maybe was conceived as like a sort of a bridging thing between them.
I think
for
it must be
readers.
Just a concept.
Yeah.
There's a new Dark Horse book called Operation Sunshine. Did anybody else get a chance to read this?
I did. I actually really liked this one. I think just conceptually it's a fun idea.
So, it's based on the 90s song Steal My Sunshine?
It is not. So this has it's written by Henry Zebrowski and Marcus Parks, who are the two non-problematic guys from last podcast.
Right,
on the left.
Yes. You mentioned that the names, Randy, and I was like, oh yeah, I think those are the guys that are at least semi-okay.
And art by David Rubin, who does really just gorgeous artwork.
He just had
Paul
that...
Paul Pope-esque.
He had that OGN of what, from like a couple weeks
yeah,
back?
Yeah, Cosmic Detective. Yeah.
But he drew, man, his stuff is special. I really enjoy
this
it.
This is set in a world, this is sort of a, it's modern times, right?
But yeah, like, it's like normal times, but there are...
there are vampires.
There's vampires.
And the vampires are OVs, which are original vampires, all these sort of monster vampires. And then they have whatever the lead character of this one is, which is called a bug.
Bug.
Which is basically someone who's turned into a vampire. They have the thirst for blood, they have the can't go in the sunlight, but they don't have any of the powers.
Right.
It is about her and another bug who is like who has basically created an Uber for blood for vampires, basically.
Yep.
And they become sort of friends, and they're on the run from original vampires, which kill bugs.
Yes.
It's some nice world building.
I was going to say the world building alone is really cool. I like their idea of cigarettes and how the bugs like yeah. that's the one
that's
thing
the one
that they can
life they can have cigarettes. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I thought that was a fun idea.
Yeah.
Again, I'm just going to reiterate, the art is gorgeous.
Art's beautiful.
And I like the story idea towards the end where you get to sort of see the twist. I'm just curious to see where it goes. It was the one book that kind of surprised me this week.
Yeah, it was a good surprise. There's a new book from Image called Haunted Girl, which is by writer Ethan Sachs and his daughter Naomi Sachs. It is based on a sort of real-life experience his daughter had with sort of depression. She was hospitalized with depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation. And he came up with this idea that he's now doing. So this is about a teenage girl who is, she just turned 16, she just gets out of this mental hospital, goes back to high school, she's struggling with sort of reintegrating and with everything she's gone through, and she starts seeing things, and it turns out she might be the savior of the world, even though she doesn't necessarily want to live.
Was this something that got actually triggered by the attempt? Like, you know, proximity to the other side?
Maybe?
Or
we don't know
like
yet.
That?
We don't know yet. Okay. It's only a 4-issue miniseries, so we'll find out pretty quickly. There's a very strange image book called Knights that I'll just read you the premise from the opening.
That's Knights like nighttime and not Knights like shining armor.
Correct. Florida is owned by Spain. America consists of 31 states. Vampires, ghosts, and other supernatural creatures are common and benign. The internet is infantile and irrelevant. That's it. That's the pitch. It's a very odd book.
That is a very odd
book.
Boy,
there's a lot going on there.
A lot going on.
All right. For the person who wants something a little off the beaten path, perhaps you've found your book.
Yeah, I think it's a girl who just, she's going back, she's going to visit, like, some new, she meets some new friends in what's called St. Pedro, which seems like a very, or Santo Pedro, which seems like a very San Francisco type place.
Okay.
As she's coming out of Florida. There is another book called Midlife, or How to Hero at 50. It is about a 50-year-old man getting superpowers.
Yep.
Another image book. Really nice art on this one, too. And then we've got some trade paperbacks this week. There's not as many as last week. There was a lot of trades. But worth noting, the Ghost Rider Epic Collection, Vengeance Reborn, that is the Danny Ketch stuff.
Mm-hmm. From
which,
the 90s,
which,
right?
Yes, which I think is probably definitive Ghost Rider stuff. Like, that was a really good reinvention.
Johnny Blaze calls that bullshit.
Well, Johnny Blaze is an angry old man with a shotgun of fire.
Sure, nowadays.
I mean, that's how he was in that run, right?
Yeah,
he was like the mentor, kind of.
Yeah. I don't know. I didn't read that run. I read the first few. I'm going to say the first dozen issues or whatever.
Yeah, it's solid.
And it is good stuff. I think I am, because of my era, I grew up a Johnny Blaze man.
I never read any Johnny Blaze.
But Danny Ketch was one of those that's like, this is how you reinvent it, right?
Yep.
The bike had never looked cooler. He went from like a 70s chopper kind of stunt cycle to a cool ninja looking motorcycle.
Yep.
They added on new powers for Ghost Rider, like the pennant stare, and like his chains he could fling them off, and the little links would break off into like little shards
stuff. They gave him a new nemesis in like Blackout the Vampire.
Yep.
Yeah.
And honestly, it had that very 90s serial killer edgy vibe with I forget who like the scarecrow-y dude was.
Scarecrow.
Was it literally just Scarecrow?
Scarecrow.
Oh my god.
Marvel Scarecrow.
Yes, more of a contortionist serial killer man than a fear.
Didn't track fear gas. Add pitchfork.
I was gonna say, didn't we have a?
We had a note for this guy for years.
Minus fear gas, plus pitchfork
equals Marvel Scarecrow.
Yes, I believe Scarecrow plus pitchfork minus fear gas equals Scarecrow.
Was the equation?
Anyway, but that is a good run. And, you know, having it all in one place with, you know, they always include all the little extra stuff like, oh, there was also a story where he was in Marvel Comics Presents.
Yep, that's in there too.
He was off visiting. He had a crossover with the X-Men or something like that. That's going to be in there too. So, you know, these epic collections are great for getting the definitive read.
We got the third and final volume of Berserker, the Keanu Reeves Immortal Warrior thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they'll probably do more because I already know one shots and stuff, but this is the main story completed. We've got Dark Ride Volume 2, the Joshua Williamson haunted sort of Disney Kingdom kind of thing.
Yep.
Godzilla Library Volume 1, the IDW started to put these big, thick trades out, so like, this is all of their Godzilla stuff.
I'm Godzilla, and welcome to my library.
Yeah. That's Godzilla with a monocle.
Yeah. They're like, it's like a definitive omnibus edition from IDW. Yep. Where each volume, each big old volume, will probably have like, I don't know, three different miniseries or ish in it.
Yep.
It looks nice. I think there's a lot of Godzilla comics they've put out, and I think fans have been largely pretty happy with their output. They've been consistent in it. You know, it's like, it's kind of like what Dark Horse did with Aliens and Predator back in the day.
Yeah.
IDW seems to have pulled off with Godzilla. But they go out of print, they're hard to find sometimes, and here you can get them all in this these nice omnibuses.
I was about to say that Godzilla should fight the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but I think that might have happened. Or is it just the Power Rangers? Godzilla Turtles, didn't that happen? I think it did. Or is it Power Rangers Turtles?
Power Rangers Turtles.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the Turtles could interact well with Godzilla.
Yeah, they could climb up on him.
The Shredder could be like trying to use him to, I don't know,
Baxter
destroy. Maybe destroy shipping stuff coming into the city from his opponents.
It's possible.
And get a stranglehold on New York.
Or he sends Godzilla to the sewers to get Shredder.
He got him. Did you mean to get Splinter?
Splinter, I knew what you meant.
Basically Godzilla lifted up one sewer lid, breathed fire into it, annihilated
everyone down
the
there.
Entire New York sewer system in one shot. Got him.
All the methane gas just exploded.
You know, really, as far as hiring out to specialists. Getting just the occasional Bebop Rocksteady, he should have just gone straight to Godzilla.
Yeah.
It's too expensive.
That said, by the way, if they were to do this, that the turtles have to, like, one of them has to, like, grow giant or something at the end so that they can fight Godzilla.
Or you can do like they did in Marvel in the 70s where Godzilla gets shrunk down and Dum-Dum Dugan swings him around by the tail.
Yeah, that was a cool issue, by the way. My brother had this issue. Godzilla has to make his way through the perils of the New York sewer system, and like he fights a rat, and it's played with as much drama as it would be any, you know, King Ghidorah or whatever.
See, Shrunky Godzilla could fight the Mousers.
I'll allow it. I'll allow for Godzilla to find his heroic edge after, of course, he burns out the entire sewer system and kills everything.
It is too bad that they don't have those are never going to be reprinted again. I got that Essential when they did a one-time printing of it. And it's really good stuff. Like, it's super fun.
It's so fun and weird. I remember all these specific issues, like one where Godzilla had gotten into, like, the kind of the heartlands of the U.S., and it was like, where was he? He was, like, in the mountains of Wyoming, and some ranchers run into him. He's literally, like, a guy goes out because something, like, spooked his cattle or something like that. But he goes out and checks it out, and in the middle of the night, he finds in this valley a sleeping Godzilla, which is just a cool idea. You're like, oh, shit.
Yep.
Be very quiet. And in the end, the ranchers aren't like, we're not going to... He's eating the cattle. What happens is that's what happens. And they're like, we're not going to be able to beat him, but we might be able to drive him off. And so they do a little, like, we've got to, like, you know, try and rope him a little bit, like, get some dynamite on his tail, all this kind of stuff. We just need to get him to leave. And that's a pretty good story.
Yeah. I can imagine roping Godzilla going well.
You know, they distract him. Other guys are distracting him. It's not like it's just guy just one dude just went up and fought him. It's a team.
Yeehaw!
I believe Nick, that the story arc that they present showed a a ranch that was not very unified before, and they kind of have to come together to fight Godzilla.
Yeah, yeah.
I think there was like an old drunk, and then there was a guy who was...
Was it Doug Mensch?
I want to say it might have been him, yeah, who did some good work on Moon Knight. Never like one of Marvel's great writers, at least for me, but like I think because of what? Shang-Chi and solid work on Godzilla and some other and Moon Knight that a good writer.
If it existed now, Godzilla would be joining the Avengers.
Yes.
Yep.
So I'm glad Marvel didn't have him.
But yeah, it still would be nice to have those reprinted just for grins.
The Turtles are now Avengers.
The
point is, in the meantime, you can get the IDW omnibus.
Everyone's an Avenger.
We also got Marvel Arms and Armor, which is one of these DK books, oversized about all the different like technology that Marvel uses,
gear and weapons and stuff. Yep, yep.
And then we got an omnibus called What If Into the Multiverse, which is the '90s What If series. Which had some of the popular, like, what if the Venom costume basically killed Spider-Man and took over the Hulk?
And, I like to imagine it actually said that. What if it basically did that?
What if it basically did this?
I have fond memories of a lot of these what-ifs.
Me too. Those are all the what-ifs I read, yeah.
What if Daredevil killed Spider-Man, or Punisher killed Daredevil, and it was a lot of fun.
And that's all collected in this big, giant hardcover. All right, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk about... all kinds of stuff. Haunted House, and board games, and movies, and some TV. Alright, so first of all, I'm going to talk about some board games that I played this weekend.
Okay.
There are a couple of them on our new shelves, one we have just on the regular shelf, but I played Ahoy, which is the nautical version of Root.
Oh, okay.
Root is
the one where little forest animals battle each other in the wilds.
It is asymmetric, which means that each faction has very different rules and different goals.
Right.
And so it's like the Cat Kingdom and the Woodland Alliance, which are basically a bunch of communist raccoons.
Uh-huh.
And the bird people who like overthrow their leaders. They're like a dynasty kind of thing.
Oh, that's fun.
And then you got the Vagabond, who is like a possum or something like that, who like can like trade with all the factions.
Okay.
There's all kinds of expansions for it, too.
Sounds fun.
My son isn't playing it on Steam. He's like obsessed with it, so I played a little bit of it. It's a really fun game. Ahoy takes this sort of anthropomorphic animal world and makes it into a pirate game.
Okay.
So you've got four factions. You've got a sort of a shark pirate, an octopus pirate, and then two sort of merchant classes. And the two pirates are more attacky. Like, they win by taking territory and fighting. And the merchants, which is what I was playing, one of those, they grab from the various islands, they grab goods, take them to their islands, and earn a reputation as couriers.
Okay.
While avoiding the being... Every time you go into a place where there's another character, you have to fight them. You have to load up your cannons and battle and that kind of thing. And so you're like, you're trying to avoid the fights because you don't really get points for them. What you want to do is like drop off goods and that kind of thing. Very fun, very different mechanics. Like each faction plays differently.
You said these are like all like sharks or octopuses and things like that. So
yep.
Sea life, piratical adventures.
Yep.
How much is the gameplay similar to Root? Or is it more just like it's a spiritual sequel, but not?
It's similar in that each board has its own like your board gives your actions. Like you know what your abilities are, and you have different.
Right.
Everybody does different things.
Yep.
So it is asymmetrical like that. And it's less about, I mean, Root is all territory taking, basically. Whereas Ahoy, two of you are playing games where you are basically just sailing around grabbing goods and delivering them and that kind of thing.
That sounds cool.
It was very fun. I enjoyed it.
I like a game that has, of course, the multiple paths to victory and stuff like that.
Yep.
And this sounds like it. Like, it's got some fun options.
I played a game that we have on our shelves called Paleo Vet, which is where you are a veterinarian in a modern-day setting, trying to heal the dinosaurs.
Yay!
And the way this works is that basically there's a row of dinosaurs, kind of like a deck building game. I think there's like five of them.
Oh.
And then you each have a board with four spaces. And each turn, if you're not full, you have to take a dinosaur.
Okay.
And the dinosaurs all have little sleepy things. They have the little Z's.
Okay.
Anywhere from two to four. And each turn at the beginning of your turn, one of the Z's goes away. And if they wake up and you don't heal them, they will escape. And if they're a carnivore, they will eat someone before they escape. So you lose two dinos. You get victory points from curing these dinos. The way you cure them is they have little symbols on them, and you roll dice each turn, and you're using the dice to both... you can use a tranquilizer to bring another dinosaur if you want extra dinosaurs into your thing.
Uh-huh.
You can use... if you do pairs or triples, you can either buy more dice that give you more rolls,
uh-huh.
or you can buy these gear. So, like, the gear is thing. There was the thing, like, if you get bonus points for each type of dinosaur at the end of the day, that's one of the gears you can buy.
Mm-hmm.
There's one that you can buy that's like a security fence, where if you buy that, when a carnivore escapes, it doesn't eat other dinosaurs.
But there was cool. one...
When the dinosaurs,
is this primarily a dice game?
It is a dice game with a card mechanic.
Okay, that sounds like kind of a cool mix.
One of the things is when you flip the new dinosaurs over, kind of like in the DC deck building, you know, when you flip with a new super villain,
yep.
like it does an attack on everybody?
Yes.
Some of the dinosaurs have what they call alerts.
Yep.
Where, like, if you flip up the dinosaur, one of them, sometimes it's good. Like, one of them was, like, the Brontosaurus, just like Gentle Giant,
mm-hmm.
and he gave everyone plus one Z on all their creatures went back more to sleep.
Okay. Hmm.
But there was also one that's, like, one of your dinosaurs loses a Z and is now more closer to a win.
Right, because it's a raptor making a lot of noise.
That kind
of
thing. So, there is one of the things you could get was the, like, alert bracelets or something, which meant you were immune to alerts.
Huh.
So there's a little technology stuff you can buy. So it's a balancing of, like, well, do I use my dice to cure my dinos, or to try and get more dice so I can cure the dinos faster, or to buy some gear that will help me out. And at the same time, you're trying to cure dinos worth points, the utmost points at the end of the game.
Is it backstabbing at all, like you want to wake up your opponent's dinos?
You can. There's a couple of bird dinos
yep.
that have no Z's on them.
Yep.
And when you take the, you can use a trank on them and trank them into somebody else's hospital.
Yeah.
And then they have to heal them immediately, or else they will fly away.
Yeah, you're like, better get to work, bro. Yeah.
So it's fun. It was a very straightforward game, pretty easy to learn. I think you'd definitely play this with kids and they would enjoy it.
Right. I like that because that would give them... It sounds like a pretty different experience than they would be getting from other games. Dinosaurs are always cool.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's a super fun game.
What's
it
about?
I really enjoyed it.
Paleo Vet?
Paleo Vet. And the other one I played is a new one we got called Spellbook.
Yeah.
It's from the designer of Sushi Go, among other things.
Good stuff.
It is from the Space Cowboys, the guys who did Splendor. Like, that's the publisher. And it's got elements of Splendor to it. Basically, you are each wizards trying to craft a spell book. And there are, on this one, you have what they call materia, which are these little discs
okay.
of seven different colors that represent, like, coal and gems and that kind of thing.
Okay.
And you have cards that represent the different spells. There's seven different colors, and there are three decks. And you can basically, the first time they play, they're like, use all from deck one. So you have seven spells, everybody has the same identical spells. And when you spend your materia to buy them, you get things like, this lets you get more materia on your turn, or this lets you trade in things, or this lets you do this. Like, all the spells do different things.
Okay.
There's cool. also level two and level three spells, where you can play, like, all level two,
mm-hmm.
all level three, or you can do what they call classic mode, where you pull randomly, and you have, like, a mix of the different spells that all do different things. Everybody always has the same spells. You're always going after the same thing, so you all know what your opponents can do.
Mm-hmm.
But it's different each time. And you draft, basically, the materia out of the bag. So it's kind of like what's the game? Azul does that. So it's like that. And you also have a board that's your familiar.
Mm-hmm.
And when you put materia, you can either put it on, try to save it to make your spells.
Okay.
So, like, you need, in order to cast, like, the green spell, you have to save three green tokens.
Sure.
And put it in there. Or you can try, there's, like, two other levels you can try to save four or five by pushing your luck and trying to cast a higher spell. Or you
Is
can...
Is this broadly a pressure luck kind
of
game?
No, not really. Okay. It's more of a set collection.
Okay.
But you also, like, each turn you can put one of your materia on your familiar, which gives it a point. It has an increasing point value.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the game ends is either someone buys all seven spells...
Mm-hmm.
Or someone gets the top level of the of their familiar, which is worth 18 points,
uh-huh.
and then the game ends and you count up points. And the spells are all worth points, but they also all do things. It's a very cool game. It's got some complexity, but it's not, like, super complicated. It sounds more complicated than it is.
Remember me, are you rival wizards?
You are rival wizards.
And is it out of curiosity, is it like a Harry Potter-esque thing? Is it like old D&D Wizards?
It's more D&D Wizards.
Okay.
Although, the familiar boards, and what, this is one of the kind of cool things, the familiar boards are all the same, they all have 18 points, but they have a different familiar on them. So the base game comes with like a dragon and a cat, and they're all cool artwork. If you buy, I think we've got three left of the promotional packs, you get four additional boards,
mm-hmm.
and there's like an owl and a sloth, and some of their cool, like, there's a unicorn, there's like four, doesn't add anything more, doesn't turn into an eight-player game or anything, but it's a little flavor, and they are cool looking. I'm glad I got the bonus pack.
Nice.
But yeah, that was my favorite. Of the three games I played, that was my favorite of the games, was Spellbook.
Those guys do make good games.
They make
Splendor
good games.
Splendor is one of those games that doesn't sound like it should be fun, but it is a lot.
Like, it's a game where you're gem merchants.
Yeah,
that's exciting.
But it also has like the good production value and all gems
chips.
And
the
chips.
Material are like that. You know, like this little these little plastic chips that are really satisfying. Yeah, it's a super fun game. Very replayable because it's got, like I say, the three different sets of spells, all going to be different every time. But the learning curve is not that sharp. Like the video I watched on it was like 15 minutes, really easy.
Okay,
definitely worth the play. I think if you like Splendor, if you like Azul, this is a game that'd be worth trying out. Dave, you and I went to Scare for a Cure for what was, I think, for me the fourth time, you the fifth time.
I think it could have been even the sixth for me.
What?
Possibly. Yeah, that's
what?
Right. I don't know. I'd have to start counting them up. And
going for,
but it's name, five or six.
Name them off. Mutant Mayhem.
All right, Mutant Mayhem, the whatever the one was that was like the Indiana Jones one.
Right, which I didn't go to that one.
The pandemic one. There was a vampire one last year?
Yes.
There was the lockdown prisoner escapees.
I did not go to that one.
There's this year, that's five. And I'm trying to think, is there a sixth one that I'm forgetting?
I thought the Mutant Man was the one that we both went to that was the first time for both of us.
Yes.
So I think you've been to five.
Okay, that's possible. How many have you done?
I think this is my third or my fourth.
Okay.
I think it's my third.
But this is a thing that it's kind of become definitely a semi-regular thing, if not regular thing.
For those who don't know, Scare for a Cure is a charity operation. It is all volunteer.
Yep.
It takes place at a ghost town outside of Manor.
Yeah, they redress, what would be probably, no doubt, like an Old West prison and warehouses and things, so that they kind of connect together, and they will always give you the impression of like you're in some kind of building, or you're in some caves, or you're in a secret excavation site,
right?
And then they dress it up, and the you go through, and there's a little bit more interaction with this than in your usual haunted house. If you go to a commercial haunted house, you're going to basically walk into a room, something, one or two things will scare you, and then they'll hurry you out.
Yeah.
Here there's a little bit more lore involved. There's a little bit of light interaction sometimes.
That's what I like. Nick, have you done haunted houses at all? Do you do haunted houses?
No, not really.
So I've never done a traditional like House of Torment or one of those.
I only recently started doing them, and I've only been a few times, but
I think I wouldn't like that the same way. This is almost like a live-action role-play in some way. You don't have to be like super into it.
But I will say, like, the production values aren't quite as high as they are in the commercial haunted houses, but there's kind of, because of the interactivity, the little bit of light interactivity, it kind of feels cooler to me.
There's a story, and you kind of have to figure out what to do. This one had, without giving too much away, we don't give it too much, there was an element we needed to collect to, like, defeat the sort of evil bad guy.
We were in a haunted museum, the one other thing that is always a commonality
the
in
blood.
These is you get covered in blood.
I used to know a volunteer from there. I still do know several volunteers from there. And she loved to use the phrase blood cannon.
Yes, they have these little cannons that go off and like spray blood, and sometimes occasionally little bits of fake gore, although you're more likely to just encounter those in other areas.
Yep.
And people all know the deal.
Yep.
The idea is you wear some clothes you don't mind either washing a couple times to get it clean, or maybe losing if it happens to not come out, but it usually does.
Sometimes you wind up with a dot of blood on your glasses forever.
Yes. In the end, you will look like essentially like some version of like the final girl in a horror movie.
It's amazing. We all came out blood soaked.
This one was particularly good. There was a new director for it, and we think that he might have been putting a little extra oomph into it. It cracks me up because sometimes usually there is some version of a guide taking you through the place you're in.
Yep.
And sometimes they will kind of clearly maneuver you into a place where you're going to get blood sprayed.
Yep.
It'll be like, what's, is there movement on that tapestry? And we all like lean in close and it's like, you'll hear like a shriek and blood is just everywhere.
Yep.
I should say it's some kind of fake blood.
Yes. We're pretty sure.
They didn't like, you know, like kill a cow or something. Like
that. Are you doing this in large groups? I can't remember.
Groups of up to six.
Yep.
So six? If you get a full group together, you don't have any randos.
Which is pretty common for like regular haunted houses too, like four or six people. And we've been always been able to these days put together a group of six pretty easily.
Yeah.
So when you show up, this place looks like pitch black. It looks you're at first you might be like, am I in the right place? But there's a little ticket area. You get in line. You go through a little sort of waiting area where they have some kind of fun early interactivity with some people that are really there. You're just in the holding thing while they wait for one or two groups to go through.
They make sure you do a little minor obstacle course. So they make sure that you can walk across things and crawl without. You can handle the small amount of physical movement that's needed.
Before I did this, I was under the impression that there was going to be like some, like I was going to have to climb a rope or something like that. Yeah. That it was going to be like this really kind of intense physical thing. It's not PE. I remember also like maybe the first or second year I went, there was a dude who looked like he was like 70. And really, they've actually made the obstacle course even a little bit lighter. You like walk on a little quick beam that's just set on the ground. It's not like some balance beam.
Right.
And you kind of just duck under a little structure that's like, I don't know, 3 feet above the ground. Right. And you can kind of crawl or duck or whatever you prefer to do.
Right.
Nowadays, that's it. Like, and that's all you're going to have to do. At some point, you will have to crawl, though.
Yep.
So if you got bad knees or something, I do have bad knees.
Yep.
But not bad enough.
I also like that, I'm not saying, we don't want to say too much about this because it's still going for the rest of the month, although I think it's sold out. But in case anybody has tickets, we're not going to spoil it for anything.
Yeah.
But the basic premise of this one was fun because basically you are ghost hunters signing up for a reality show pilot ghost hunting this museum that's been in Texas for 50 years.
Yeah, and there's like some certain serial killers and things like that from history that have some ties to it. There's some members of the staff that have gone missing, and there might be some plot elements with them. There's some little puzzles to be done. There's almost always a sort of showdown element at the end with the bad guy. And it's always very fun. They do a good job with their props. It's often funny. You know, and sometimes it's like nervous laughter. They did not particularly do it this year, but sometimes there is a little bit of an element where like one person might be somewhat, they'll whisper to you, do you want to like participate in this? You might be pulled off to the side and briefly imprisoned by the monsters or something like that, that they stage. This year they didn't, and it worked just fine without it too. What was it called? Museum of Madness or something like that.
Museum of Madness, I think,
Yeah. Very fun, and I was, because I had gotten, like, I believe last year somehow, or the year before that, the blood I got mostly somehow was on my jeans, and it looked like I'd been shot in the leg, but nothing on my upper body. This year, I was like two or three rooms in, bam.
Yeah, you got cut in like the first or second room.
Yes.
You got blood all over the face. You had a bloody face the entire night.
I felt very cool. I felt like I was in a horror movie.
Yeah. And then we all went to Whataburger after.
We all went to Whataburger afterwards, yes, and we did get some stairs. Even though I know that they must get that somewhat.
It's 5 minutes from there. I guarantee you we're not the only people who have gone there.
But the person who was ringing us up was kind of like, you guys okay? Anyway, it is a fun thing that is like, it's spooky, but it's not scary.
Right.
I think that, I think people could do this even if you are not usually like as... It's not as intense as a haunted house, to be honest.
Right. And it's what, an hour long, basically, you know?
Yeah, 45 minutes to an hour. It's very fun if you like a little bit of role-playing thing or if you've ever... I don't LARP, but I know it must be at least a little like this.
Yeah.
And you get to see the lore unfold, and you get to feel like a cool horror action hero or victim.
It's a blast. I like to do it every year if possible. We almost missed it this year because we almost missed signing up for it.
Yeah, that was a big oops on our part.
And I believe, Dave, is it around about 50 bucks a person? Isn't that about what we want?
Something like that, yeah.
So it's not as cheap as like House of Torment or anything.
Right, but it's a good cause.
Yeah, it mostly goes to breast cancer research.
And they do things that you're not going to get at a commercial haunted house,
right.
like the slightly better, deeper story and like the gore.
Yeah. It's a blast, and we do it every year. And I this might have been my favorite one that I've done with the three or four that I've done.
Yeah. It was
a lot of All right, we all watched a new Amazon Prime movie called Totally Killer.
Yep.
Which stars Mad Men's Kiernan Shipka.
Yep.
Also Sabrina. A ton of other stuff.
Sabrina yeah.
And I think spiritually lines up with kind of some lighter novelty slasher movies from the last several years, such as Happy Death Day.
And Freaky.
Which was like Groundhog Day meets a horror movie. Yep. And Freaky, which was literally like the Freaky Friday switch around,
yep.
but where a like a final girl type heroine gets switched with like Jason type yep. person, yeah. and they both experience some of each other's lives. And it actually even has some of that element of a Freaky Friday, which is like, is this heartwarming?
Yeah.
But it also has all kinds of dark humor. So continuing that tradition is one that starts in the present and has a big Back to the Future motif.
Yes.
Yep.
And will end up putting a girl into the 1980s where her mother was around for a scary serial killer series of murders.
Yeah, so this starts in 2023.
Yep.
Kiernan Shipka is a high school like sophomore. She's like 16 or 17.
Yeah.
And her mom, played by Modern Family's Julie Bowen.
Yep. Love Julie Bowen.
I forget who the dad is. He was looked familiar to me, too. I don't remember who
he's been
actors.
In a bunch of, like,
but
those
it's minor,
movies.
But he's funny.
He is funny. So they're like her dorky parents, and they, in 1987, her mom's three friends were all killed by this serial killer, Sweet 16 killer, because he stabbed people 16 times.
Yep.
And he killed a girl on her 16th birthday.
Yep.
Or something like that.
And he was dressed as, like, a kind of with a creepy costume.
Almost like a Beavis or Butthead mask, kind of.
Yeah, but there's also a little bit of a, like, he almost looked like a creepy horror version of, like, a Young Republican.
Yeah, he's got this big head mask, and
the mask has, like, combed back hair and a leering grin.
Yeah.
It's a good, solid new look for this kind of killer.
So this town, Vernon, is known for having, they had this murder. There's a guy who does a podcast about it. They had these murders. It was never solved. The guy killed three women and then disappeared. And this starts with the mom being attacked.
Yep.
And killed by the serial killer as soon as it returned, 16 years later? 20 years later? What is 1973?
Definitely more than 16.
It's
but
like, it's a lot.
Yeah, it's like 25 or 30 years later.
It's the same, it's probably the same difference as 1984 and 1950, whatever.
In Back to the Future, yeah.
The Kiernan Shipka's character is very distraught by this, and fortunately, her friend is working on a time machine.
Yep. They kind of hurry a little bit past
it's the one thing you got to buy into.
Right. They hurry a little through the point, but it's fine. I think if you're there at all, you kind of know the premise, and you're like, I want to see this girl dropped into 1987 and have fun
yep.
and explore a mystery, a serial killer mystery.
Yep.
So, like, don't get hung up on that.
Well, and the big thing is that it's based off of blueprints and ideas from her friend's mom.
No, yeah, yeah.
Meaning that when she goes back in time, there is a possibility of getting her back to the future.
Right. So that's one thing I want to say. I think structurally, this is the strongest horror movie I've seen this summer, or this Halloween season, because everything is lined up to make sense.
It's very tightly plotted in its way.
This is, by the way, the creator of this also did Don't Trust the Bee in Apartment 23.
Yep.
Nanochka Khan is her name. I think it's her. I think
it
it's
is.
Her. Yeah.
It is her.
And she did another movie that I like, too. I can't remember what it was. But
Randy, you're talking about structure, and that reminded me, kind of, though, that there's a lot of characters that are possible red herrings.
Yes.
Maybe they're the killer, maybe they're not. That you will be seeing sometimes simultaneously in the past and the present.
Yes.
Or you've seen a good deal of them when they're older in the present, and now we're seeing them when they're younger as a kid. There's a whole lot of jokes and humor. Like, much of the movie is rooted around, oh, wow, the 80s were this crazy time. Just like Marty McFly finding out his mom was, like, very loose. Everybody is smoking in the 80s. They're talking about doing coke.
Yep.
But she's also like, oh, my God. She's like, I've got gummies in 2023.
She's like, 80s weed sucks.
That, like, are, like, 100 times more powerful than your shitty weed.
She's also, she is trying to be, like, she goes back. The first thing she gets is mixes a dodgeball game in school. And she's like, how is this even legal?
Yes.
And her mom, it turns out, is, like, the popular girl. She
she's
and her
like
friends,
a mean girl.
They were the Mollies. They all dress like Molly Ringwald. Different versions of them.
Yep. And as you know, Randy, it's also a meta-contextual kind of reference to Heathers.
Yeah.
It was Always Be My Maybe.
Always Be My Maybe.
Which is why Randall Park is there.
Which is a great movie. Randall Park plays the sheriff. But
what I was going to say is there's a lot of characters, and it's very fun to kind of watch and sort of guess at who did it, who didn't. Is there some kind of crazy Scream premise?
Mm-hmm.
And of course there is the, you know, is she going to be able to stop the murders?
They keep you guessing at who the killer is very effectively. I thought that was really well done. I also liked that we see stuff in the future where her friend and the podcast guy are discovering, oh, she's changing time, and we're remembering. He's like, wait, I know every detail of this, but I've forgotten that. And he realizes that time is changing around them.
Right.
I really like their time travel mechanics.
Yeah, it was a little as if we had seen scenes in Back to the Future, as, you know, that photograph starts to fade of, like, the future changing just slightly here and there.
And I like that basically she's trying to be the responsible. She starts off as the teenager bad-mouthing her mom. And then she goes back in time, and she's the responsible one trying to get her mom, who is now a crazy teenager, to, like, stop going to parties, stop doing dangerous stuff. There's a serial killer hunting you.
Yep.
Right.
She tries to go to the police and tell them that, like, she will, she's like, there's going to be a murder out from the future, and none of them believe her, of course.
And she hilariously, like, just says, listen, this is going to go a lot quicker if you just have seen the movie Back to the Future.
Yep. Some people haven't.
Right.
I also like that she settles on pretending she's a psychic. Which I thought was a clever way to explain her future knowledge.
Right, which is, like, her mom kind of pretty easily buys into.
Well, she knows her mom had a crystal that she gave to her.
Yeah.
So she knows her mom believes in psychics.
Right.
There's a lot of nice little, you know, stuff that kind of adds up.
I think I was the one who liked this best of any of my... I like it better than the two of you, and better than Serena, and better than most of my friends who've seen it. And I think you'll tight the script is. Cause,
no. I mean,
I think you're overvaluing...
Because I have seen too many horror movies this season where it's all atmosphere and the story doesn't come together.
I get that.
Yeah.
I would say my criticisms are that it leans a little heavily on the weren't the 80s crazy gags.
It does overdo that a little bit. I will absolutely own that, yeah.
And I'm trying to think. I feel like there were one or two other things. Every once in a while, I thought the tone was a little wonky, and it's like, oh, are we going to be, like, very lightweight comedy, or are we going to occasionally veer too serious?
They definitely let people get killed.
They do let people get killed.
Yeah, the kills are actually pretty good.
There's a bit where she's like, okay, well, I've successfully changed the order in which they get killed.
Right.
I thought with time travel that maybe they were going to do a thing where she got to go back again and try and prevent all the kills.
Yeah.
But they did not do that. This vibe for me a lot like what I liked about Scream and that kind of thing, too. There's definitely some nods to Scream.
I think if people go into it kind of looking for something that is, you know, one of these somewhat more lightweight ones like Happy Death Day, I think Scream has, like, notably stronger drama in it.
Yeah.
Scream just is a better movie in general.
It is, although Randy might disagree because he's a weirdo.
Scream's a better movie.
Oh, okay.
But Scream's great. This is just...
It is a very good time. Like, especially if you're just, you know... You should just throw it into your Halloween mix.
Yeah, for sure.
Go ahead and see it. Don't be a part
of
it.
So, of the two sort of buzzy ones that are going around, I like this way better than No One Will Save You.
No One Will Save You.
Which Dave has not seen yet. We're going to try and talk about it next week because Nick and I have both seen it.
Yes.
Nick, you and I are also still on spooky season viewing, so we've been watching some other stuff.
Yep.
I watched about three of the Simpsons Treehouse of Horrors, because I don't know if you guys know this, there are 35 seasons of Simpsons.
Yes.
And I have seen maybe 15 of them. So I've just been kind of spot-watching the later... And there are some that are weaker. There's a couple that are just, like, weaker ones. But there was a couple that were really good. There's one that has an opening by Guillermo del Toro that has... It's the Simpsons couch gag, but it is the Guillermo del Toro version.
Okay.
So it's like, there's references to all his movies. It's the same various Simpsons characters, various horror movies. There's a reference to some kind of haunted car movie, not Christine, but like a guy, Maggie driving a haunted car. That's a reference to a movie I never heard of. A lot of sort of deep cut. There's Pan's Labyrinth gets referenced, and of course, all his stuff.
35 seasons, you're going to get into some deep cuts.
Yeah.
Well, I watched some of those in the last few years, and didn't they do, like, a Junji Ito one or something?
Yes, I haven't seen that one yet, I don't think.
And there was, like...
Like a full-on, that's, like, one of the stories in a Treehouse of Horror?
I think so. I saw one or two weird ones in the last few years, because I haven't kept up with them, like, for decades. But I watched one or two, like, there was a recent one that was kind of notable. And I remember watching it, Randy, maybe you can remind me, it was, like, 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
But I was like... It was pretty fun. It was pretty good. It was, you know, it's kind of fun to go back sometimes.
So the one I watched was the one I remember, the best one I saw of the three or four I watched. Guillermo del Toro did the opening. Then there was the Oh, the Places You'll Doe, which is a riff on Dr. Seuss, of all things.
Okay.
But a horror take where basically Homer is the Cat in the Hat and he's a monster.
That makes perfect sense, honestly.
And it's very weird and fun. Then there was Dead and Shoulders, where Bart accidentally cuts off his head and is attached to Lisa's body. And then Freaks No Geeks, which is a riff on the 1930s Freaks movie, which is actually a really good one.
By the way, the one I just remembered, the one that I'd been thinking about was their Death Note one.
Oh, yeah.
That they did like a that few
one,
years ago.
I did see that one, and that was really good.
Yeah, pretty fun stuff.
And then, yeah, so the other one of the ones I saw was like a. They did a particle accelerator story where they created a little black hole accidentally.
Uh-huh.
And it was all right, but it was a weird one. They did, when that one had Paranormal Activity in it as well. Their Paranormal Activity was really good. I've never seen Paranormal Activity.
Yep.
But the Simpsons version of it was
pretty
good.
I got the gist of it.
Yep.
I think and it's then, akin to watching
and then they did a Back to the Future riff where Bart goes back in time and prevents Marge from marrying Homer, and he goes back, and his father is now Artie Ziff, the sort of smart kid that was Homer's rival in the old flashbacks. He's voiced by John Lovitz. And Bart has the weird, like, Artie Ziff hair and stuff. It was a fun... It's weird because sometimes they just do, like, sci-fi. It's not actually horror. They'll do, like, these sci-fi stories. Like, all right, this is our excuse to tell whatever weird stories you want to tell.
Right.
And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But mostly, even in the seasons or lesser, I'm like, oh, the Halloween stuff's always good.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that became a Simpsons thing to do these great Halloween specials. I appreciate that that's one of their legacies.
Nick, you watched a Town That Dreaded Sundown?
Yeah, so I was listening to a podcast that was ranking all of the Blumhouse horror, and I'd seen a bunch of them. Like, the vast majority of the list I'd seen.
Okay.
But this one got mentioned as being kind of mid-tier, and I was like, oh, you know, I've never seen the original, which was a 70s horror film. Not really widely respected. I think it's like 47% on Rotten Tomatoes, if you care.
Okay.
But this one is one of those weird ones where it's not a sequel. It's kind of a requel in a lot of ways.
Okay.
So it takes the idea that the events happened, and it's actually a true story. There was a serial killer in Texarkana, Texas, which is a small town on the border of
Used to drive to Arkansas. Yep.
Yeah, Arkansas and Texas. And I think it was called the Moonlight Murders or something. And this happened in the 70s. Somebody made a movie about it. They take that conceit that the movie was made, and this is happening in present day, which this thing came out in 2014, I think, the remake.
Okay, all right.
And they're kind of like, there are these weird... They watch the movie as kind of like a remembrance and like a horrible, like, midnight movies, kind of like drive-ins. Like, right.
It's got a cult remembrance.
Remembrance.
Yeah.
And the murders start happening again. The kind of killer in this is called Bagman. Not a very exciting title.
That's a creepy-sounding name.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess it is. And he wears kind of like a sack over his head, and he talks, and he utilizes a lot of weaponry, so it is a very, like, gore-centric, like, very happy with its kills and blood fest.
Blumhouse doing a more, in its way, more traditional kind of slashery or...
But I don't know if I can, like, highly, you should watch this movie, but it was, I think it was entertaining, and an interesting exercise.
I did not even remember this remake happening. I haven't seen any version of this movie either, but...
Well, no, I haven't seen the original either.
That sounds kind of interesting.
And, like, the people in it, Gary Cole is in it as, like, the sheriff. And you've got kind of, like, the Midwestern town of, like, horrible individuals who don't know what they're doing. And the kids...
There's some people that you want to see get slapped?
Yes, 100%. I was happy to see some of them get killed.
You always need people you want to see get killed.
Yes. Yep. I enjoyed it. I don't know if you should race out to watch it, but it is streaming on, I believe, Amazon Prime.
Nick's highest recommendation.
Press play.
Yes. I always say press play. Uh-huh. You'll never know what you're going to find that you might enjoy. That's the thing. I found many movies that I was like, I'll just watch this for the hell of it, and really, really enjoyed it. This one was just mid-enjoy. The next movie that I saw was kind of spooky. Sort of. I mean, it's Haunting in Venice. It's the Agatha Christie, Hercule Poirot.
Right, but if one were to have watched just the trailer for this, you'd be like, "Oh, it's a horror movie."
Yeah,
and then like in the, like at the very near the end of the trailer, you're like, "Oh, that's one of those Poirot mysteries or whatever."
It was a good fake out, kind
it's
of.
It's a good fake out, and I was not quite sure how much that would be represent the movie. Nick, how supernatural do they want you to think it might be?
A little bit. There's okay. definitely that element of it. The conceit of this one is that Hercule Poirot has sort of, like, gone into retirement in a lot of ways. He's living in Venice, and he gets approached by, essentially, their Agatha Christie stand-in as a author who made him who he was, essentially.
Okay.
This one is played by Tina Fey. She does a really good job of being
That's interesting.
I knew she was in the movie, but I had no idea what the role was.
It's a clever thing for her because she is very likable, but she's very pushy and kind of pushes him out of retirement to come to a seance, saying that she can't figure out how this woman is doing it. The woman who's doing the readings is Michelle Yeoh.
Like that.
And in the process of the reading, Michelle Yeoh gets killed for various reasons. So it becomes a very kind of everyone gets stuck in this one house. Poirot won't let anybody leave, and it's a whodunit with a mixture of ghosts and scares.
Okay, I gotta say, solid premise.
It's a solid premise. I actually think it's honestly, I like Murder on the Orient Express, the movie. Maybe the best out of all of the three.
Yep.
But this is definitely a very close second.
Okay.
This one I don't think is as flashy with its actors. I mean, you have Tina Fey and Michelle Yeoh. Those are fairly
like. But like the original Orient Express was very much a everybody gets to bite their sink their teeth into whatever their character was.
But it also had like a laundry list of people that were recognizable. Johnny Depp.
This still does too, though, doesn't it?
Sort of, but after Tina Fey and Michelle Yeoh, it's a lot of like lesser known individuals, like people you recognize, but they're not like
they didn't get Anthony Hopkins to play the Duke,
right? Like there was no, it didn't feel stunt casted,
okay? Because everything Branagh does is stunt casted, including all of his Shakespeare stuff.
But but this feels like Branagh kind of reined it in a little bit,
interesting,
and more focused on kind of.
Sounds like he hit a budgetary limitation.
And you know that if that was the case,
but you think he kind of worked for it?
I think he worked with it, and he worked really well. I think Venice as a location is kind of creepy in and itself.
Yeah,
but it was also gorgeous. There's a lot of good like shots of the city.
One of the things with these kind of Agatha Christie mysteries is a little bit of that sort of globe hopping exotic vibe that's kind of usually kind of fun to do.
Also, I have a soft spot for Branagh. I always have. I've liked his Shakespeare stuff. I really
you like his murder movie.
I liked his movie Dead Again.
Yeah.
You like his Thor.
I do like his Thor. I think he's also very good as Hercule Poirot.
He is good.
He kind of chews the scenery.
It's funny because like he is both meta. He's kind of meta contextually made fun of himself with the dude from the Harry Potter movies. What was that?
Oh, Gilderoy Lockhart.
Gilderoy
Lockhart.
And
that was him.
And Poirot is also a kind of full of himself detective. He tends to play these characters, but he's pretty good at them.
Well, the thing with Hercule Poirot, though, is he can back it up. Gilderoy Lockhart was all sham.
Right, sure. But they are both hams in their way.
But this one is a little more human. He's a little out of step in some ways, so he's always kind of maybe a step behind. He's still smart and makes the connections, but he's not what he was.
Who would win in a detective off between him and Columbo and Benoit Blanc?
Oh. Man, that's a really good question.
I believe Benoit Blanc to be the superior detective amongst those three.
But Columbus sneaks up on you.
Columbus sneaks up on you. I don't know. I think I would have to go maybe Columbo as kind of the dark horse. But you throw Hercule, I don't know. He's very talented.
I've stumped you.
Yeah, you have.
We'll work on this one. Send us an email entitled
"Which Detective
Poirot versus Columbo versus Benoit," and tell us who you think would win and why.
I want them all in a case.
And you might
though.
Win nothing other than we might mention you.
But I do recommend this one. I hated Death on the Nile, which was the second one, and that one was just so overbloated. And
you know, I remember just a few minutes ago when Nick said he loved Brenna. He had a soft spot for Brenna.
That was all over.
Remember that? And then he's just like, Death on the Nile, also, pure shit.
That also did cast the person who likes to eat people. What's his name?
Yeah, you know. What is that guy's name? Actual cannibal.
Oh, Armie Hammer.
He was in that.
He's from the Arm and Hammer fortune. That's so just weird. Messed up to call him Armie
Hammer. Yeah, it was
that's
really bad.
The weirdest of all.
I mean, he's probably that's why he became.
But let me ask this though: is you know, sometimes I can remove myself from it. He didn't actually kill anybody in real life. He's got some kind of weird kinks or whatever, and he might. I can't remember. Was he like coercive? I don't want to dive too deep into it, but anyway, my point is only this. How was his acting in it?
It was fine. Oh, he's always fine. Right. Leave him alone.
Did he eat anyone?
He did not eat anyone.
That we know of.
He did make the Lone Ranger, so that was bad.
Oh.
He's not, like, the greatest track record for movies. And Death on the Nile was just kind of a bloated mess for me.
I remember watching a little bit, and I remember there's a cool little jazz scene earlier.
Yeah, there's some good moments. All right. It just stayed too
long. But I wasn't so compelled that I finished watching it, so...
Haunting in Venice, go watch that. It's
okay.
Very good.
That sounds fun.
And then I watched The Black Coat's Daughter, which I was expecting from the title to be, like, in,
a
like...
A pirate?
Well, I was thinking, like Revolutionary War times or something.
Okay.
Some but stand no, and deliver
I don't
kind
know
of
what,
highwayman.
The Black Coat is... I don't know what the reference is. I don't understand it. But it is about... And I won't say too much, because I know Dave hasn't seen it. You've seen it, Nick, or no?
I think I did.
That is correct.
So, I feel like I may have started it and I fell asleep or something.
So this is also Karen Shipka. It's Karen Shipka week at the Lady household. And Emma Roberts, who I love.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of parallel stories. Karen Shipka is playing a girl who seems to have been abandoned by her family over the holidays at this boarding school, this Catholic boarding school that she goes to. So she and this other girl are there. The other girl, it seems... is pregnant, possibly by the dean or something. There's like some implication that she is, or no, she goes and talks to her boyfriend. She basically is going to get an abortion, and she gets stuck having to protect Kieran and Shipka because she's not, her family hasn't going to pick her up, and she's alone. They're alone with these nuns, and it seems like they're like it's very isolated. There's only like four people there. It's very spooky. The music is throughout is like this is all spooky, and at the same time. Amber Roberts is playing a character who is picked up by James Remar.
Okay.
Always creepy.
Yeah.
Watch out for that.
Yes, he is.
He is in this, she is sort of on her own, and he comes up to her and he's like, hey, would you need a ride or anything? And he and his wife give her a ride in their car. And there's definitely an implication, like, is he trying to seduce her?
Right.
You know, what's going on? His wife seems to not have any... She's like, why are you picking up this girl? What are you doing? He's like, I'm just trying to help her.
Yeah,
and they're like, they're going somewhere. And these two stories, I don't want to say exactly that they dovetail, but they start to dovetail together in an interesting way. And there's also implications. The girl is telling Kieran Shipka that at some point someone was worshiping the devil in the basement of this school. And so there's like a demon worship kind of thing going on. It's all very moody. It's very haunting. But I felt like it was really slow. And I felt like, again, I don't know that the ending is actually solid. Like, it all comes together pretty well. But the lead up in this one, I felt like was a little weak. I'm like, tell me your story, because I can't quite tell what you're trying to tell.
You know what's interesting, though? What you're describing all sounds interesting to me.
Yeah. You might like it. This definitely seems a bit divisive. I know some people really like it. I thought it was okay.
Yeah.
And I thought a lot of it was on the strength of the performances. James Remar, Karen Shipka, Emma Roberts, all good, and they're all good in
the
roles.
I think I did start.
I do like some James Remar, who was, of course, oddly enough, also in Oppenheimer.
I mean, he's in a lot of stuff.
He's in a lot of stuff.
He's also in The Warriors. He's also in Dexter.
Yep.
That's right.
That guy was a wildling kind of rogue guy in the Shannara Chronicles on MTV.
Sure.
He gets around, and he's about, and yet he's going to be in the almost certainly Oscar nominated Oppenheimer.
Yep.
You got a job, he'll take it.
Wasn't he also in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
I believe he was.
And was he also in Battlestar Galactica?
Yes, he was one of the skeevy...
Wasn't Sarek?
He was Sarek's, like, second-hand man.
He was Sarek's right-hand man, yeah.
And then I want to real quick touch on Loki Season 2, which came back. And honestly, it's all about Ki-Hai Kwan.
He definitely kind of steals the first episode.
So he joins, they have Mobius and Loki together again at a new TVA that's been reformed, and it turns out that Kang formed it.
Right. And Loki is unstuck in time.
Yes, Loki is unstuck in time. And so they have to go down to the repair department or whatever.
Yep.
Run by Ouroboros, or as his nickname is, OB.
Yep.
And as played by a very delightful Kihoi Kwan.
AKA who, guy who broke out from Everything Everywhere All at Once, but yep. You might remember as Short Round.
Yep. And he is so good and so uplifting, and like, he is like, he's the guy who, his whole thing is like, he is the only repair guy the TVA has, so his little vacuum tubes come down and he immediately fixes it, and they're like, he's like, you don't sleep, you don't rest, he's like, no, I just stay here and fix things. And they need him to help get Loki unstuck in time, or re-stuck to time, and he's talking about, Loki shows up, and he's like, yes, I've been time-slipping. He's like, you can't time-slip in the TVA, it's impossible. And then Loki, like, vanishes. He's like, oh, well, I guess you can.
I'm very conflicted about this.
Yes. it's super fun. They're definitely doing a lot about the internal politics of the TVA, now that their origins have been revealed, and the whole thing about them stealing variants has been revealed, and all
and
that kind of
Ravana
thing.
Ravana has disappeared.
Ravana's disappeared.
Leaving the other kind of main judges to kind of splinter and go in their different ways.
Right.
Kihei Kwan is great. I really, really enjoy Owen Wilson in this role.
He's fantastic in this,
He kind of delivers kind of mundane things, like his jet ski monologue, mm-hmm. that is actually just a brand name as was very entertaining. And
I haven't seen this season, but I thought he was great in the first season.
Yeah.
A very instantly likable kind of weird bureaucrat guy, but yep. who's like, he's bucking the system in his own way.
The first episode back is a delight. And this is, mm-hmm. it's also the production value of this, where the TVA looks like an old government building from the 70s.
Yeah.
Like, I love every bit of the design. The little time space suit that Owen Wilson wears is a great design.
It is.
Like, it has an aesthetic that I really like. It feels, I feel like they definitely mainlined a lot of Terry Gilliam's Brazil when they were designing all this.
So the directors of this, I can't remember their name. Is it
Is it the same guys?
It's not Michael Waldron. Michael no. Waldron was the guy who...
Right.
And now he's doing executive producing it.
Right.
The directors of this, why can I not find
they were,
it?
I feel like they've done some other stuff, and I think...
Well, they worked on Moon Knight.
Moon Knight, right.
But
right.
They also have done a couple of, full-on movies prior to this. One of them called The Endless.
Okay.
They're very kind of sci-fi.
So Eric Martin, who's one of the guys...
and Moorhead?
Did Heels and Rick and Morty.
Okay.
Is he one of the original creators? So I think you seem to remember Rick and Morty were the names. I'm looking to see the names on here that are like the current guys. I think he may be the new showrunner. Yeah, he's... Well, it says 2021 and 2023. I don't know.
Why do they make this hard to find?
I don't know. Is it the directors who were... Yeah, Moorhead and Benson.
Moorhead and Benson. They did Endless and a couple of other feature films. They're... very wild sci-fi people.
Yep.
And I know they worked on Moon Knight, and I think they worked on one other Marvel property, so they've kind of been like, they work well with the Marvel world.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think this is a really, really good first episode that basically just steps in after season two.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a direct continuation. It kind of changes a few things, like how I thought they were ending season one. They kind of swerve a little bit that I was not expecting. I'm looking forward to... Was this on Thursdays now?
They keep
changing things.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I thought it was a really good first episode back. I'm very excited to see where they go. All right, I think that'll wrap it up for us this time. We'll be back next week with more. Until that time,
Yo, Joe!
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.